Okay. My topic, well, at first it sounds a bit paradoxical. So, whoops. Let's see. Where's an eraser? So, it's called complex zeros. Of real ergodic eigenfunctions. And this is a very new result, let's say about 3 days old or something. So to be on the safe side, I'll call it work in progress, though I believe that the proof is both complete and correct. One or the other might not be true, but okay, so I'm going to be working on a real analytic Riemannian manifold. So you can think of a compact hyperbolic surface, for example. It's a nice example. I guess I should say this will be compact, although actually we never use compactness. But and I'm interested in the eigenvalue problem. So I parametrize the eigenvalues by lambda j squared, and this will be an orthonormal basis. And what I'm interested in is the zeros of the eigenfunctions. Well, there are two different kind of zeros to be interested in here. So I'll use z, tj. Sometimes I'll drop the phi and just call it zj, which is contained in the manifold. This is the real zero set. The famous nodal line. So the nodal line tends to look something like this, really walk around in a very curly kind of a way. On the other hand, it's going to take me a while to explain what I mean by it, but I'm going to be interested in the complex zero set. So I'm going to be complexifying the eigenfunction, and this is going to be the set of point z in the complexification of the manifold where the complexified eigenfunction is equal to zero. And the problem is, you know, determine the behavior of the integral over the zero set in principle in either sense as lambda j goes to infinity. So it's the asymptotics of the nodal hypersurfaces. Well, if I were to study the real zero set first, I would be asking for a huge amount of trouble, because what is even known about it? So real zeros, the nodal line problem, so almost nothing is known. What is known is a theorem of Donnelly and Pfefferman, from around, I have the paper with me, I think it could be around 85 actually, it's not a new theorem. And it says that if we just let f be the constant function, 1, then just the Hausdorff n minus 1 measure, which is just the Riemannian surface measure of the nodal set, that's the real one, is bounded by up and below by constant times lambda. So remember that lambda j squared is my Laplace eigenvalue. So this was a conjecture of Yao and Cheng and Yao, and they proved it for real analytic metrics. But you notice that there's no asymptotics for the surface measure, much less an equidistribution law for the zeros. And that just seems kind of foolishly out of control.
This is for ergodic.
No, this is real analytic.
Not assumption on the metric.
Well, just real analyticity. And in fact, you know, it's obtained by local arguments. So, the theme of my talk is that we can actually answer this problem for the complex nodal hypersurfaces. So, in fact, the result is easy to state, although it's going to take some time to produce all the definitions, but I'll just state the answer. So, first of all, one of the differences between the real and complex case is that it's difficult to start off with an eigenfunction or any function and write down a convenient formula for the delta function on its zero set. But for complex hypersurfaces, it is easy to write it down. So the formula is that this is, I'll describe it a little bit more, but up to some constants, 1 over 2 pi I, this is called the Poincaré-Lelong formula. One can actually construct the delta function on the zero set just by kind of differentiating the logarithm of an analytic function. And but what kind of a thing is this? This is what's called a 1-1 form. It's actually not the right thing to do to just put a kind of volume measure on the zero set. In fact, if you like, by what's called Verdinger's formula, we'll get there in a second, but this is sort of the Kähler form, just restricted to the zero set. I haven't told you what Kähler form yet, but it's a 1-1 form. So a 1-1 form means that in local coordinates, it has it's a differential form, a 2-form, which has one z and one z bar coordinate in each term, and coefficients which are not smooth. Of course, it's a delta function, so they're supported on the zero set. So it's sort of like a differential form with distribution coefficients. That's called a current, and it's a better way to analyze integration over the zero set than to look at the surface measure and to integrate scalar functions. So my theorem is I think it's proved, but in any case, just to be careful, I'll put it in quotation marks, that 1 over lambda j. So here's the distribution law for the complex current. So here, I'm on a Riemannian manifold. And as I will explain, the complexification of the manifold can be viewed as a ball bundle, a subset of the cotangent bundle. So this function over here is just the usual metric function. It's a real-valued function. And I have a complex manifold, and I'm going to take dd bar of that expression.
This is almost everywhere.
Thank you. What are my assumptions? Assume that the geodesic flow is ergodic, and that the phi lambda j is an ergodic sequence, meaning a phi j tends to the average value of the symbol on the sphere bundle with respect to Liouville measure. So I don't think what?
It's the first thing as well, that GT is ergodic.
Yes. Oh, but absolutely, because it's not true otherwise. It's very easy. I mean,
you know, it's not just a potential theoretic statement, yeah, that if the second thing is true, if this last thing is true, that that's true.
Yeah.
That's his question. I mean, the first thing ensures that the second one's true for a density one.
Yeah, so this implies that. This implies that there's a huge
sequence. Does your theorem, is your theorem just really the second implies?
Yes. Yes. This
implies that. Okay.
Implies that.
We don't need the ergodic.
In other words, it's a purely potential.
Nothing to do with the ergodic.
Well, it does in the sense that there's no other Riemannian manifold. It's true. You could state the theorem this way. Given any sequence like this, then this is true.
Okay. So his question is very good.
Right. Okay. Yes. All right. Now, still trying to understand the statement, let's complexify manifolds. Try to understand what they are. Well, let's do the simplest example. When I first saw this result, I was a bit surprised by it. Because, as we'll see, the right-hand side is not the calometric on the cotangent bundle. So it has a rather strange distribution law. And you can see from it that the right-hand side is invariant under the geodesic flow. So the distribution of zeros is geodesically flow invariant. I don't know any other simple way of even seeing that part. So let's just do the simplest example. This is the one and only ergodic example that I know how to calculate by hand, the circle. So let's just take the circle. There's only one metric on it. And if we take the circle, so the eigenfunctions, well, we could do cosines, but let's just take sines. Let's not worry about the normalization. And we start off with the circle, and we complexify it. So this is S1C, and this is just C modulo Z. It's just a cylinder. It's a complexification of a circle. And let's look at the complexification of the eigenfunctions. So let me call this phi k of x. And the complexification of the eigenfunction is just, of course, sine of kz. So the real zeros of this, these are the set of points which are the form, I guess, pi n over k here, forms a set which is becoming uniformly distributed along the circle. And the complex zero set, well, the holomorphic sine function has only real zeros. So actually, the complex zero set is the same exact thing. It's just a set of points, pi n over k. They're all real. And so, as k tends to infinity, if we divide by the number of zeros, which is essentially the square root of the eigenvalue, 1 over k times this, this would just be 1 over k times the sum of delta functions at these zeros, xn. This approaches, if you like, a delta function on the set where the xi variable, the momentum variable, is 0. So here's the x variable. So first of all, by the way, in this simple example, you see that the complexification of the manifold can be identified with the cotangent bundle, first of all. And so we get this answer. Now let's suppose that we compare it to this. Well, the metric is just constant. So the metric function, C, is just y, you know, it's just the absolute value of C. And dd bar, d here, would be d by dx plus 1 over I d by dxc. There's no x, so we're just taking 2xc derivatives. So we're just taking 2xc derivatives of absolute value of c, and we see that this does equal the second derivative of the absolute value of c. When I first saw this example, the fact that you got a delta function along the zero section of the cotangent bundle struck me as some crazy anomaly in one dimension, and I kept fighting it and trying to think that the zeros must be better distributed, but actually it fits into the pattern of the result. So as that example indicates, but less so in higher dimensions, the distribution of complex zeros is singular along the zero set, zero section. So let me just sort of make that plausible for a second, why that happened. It's in a way obvious why that happened. So note that, you know, phi lambda j is real valued on the set where c is equal to 0. I could put a c there if I like. And that implies that the 0 set of the complexification is invariant under, you know, the natural involution on the cotangent bundle, which corresponds to complex conjugation. It's invariant under complex conjugation. So the concentration of the zeros is on the fixed point set, right? So the zeros, complex zeros, concentrate on the fixed point set. Okay, so I'd like to sketch the proof. And so the first thing to understand is just what happens when you complexify analytic Riemannian manifolds. So Reznikov's talk this morning also alluded to this. So there's a, the first result is due to Bruhat and Whitney. And it just says that M can always be thickened or complexified into a complex manifold as a totally real submanifold. That means given any tangent vector, if you multiply by I, it rotates it completely out of the tangent space of M. So the picture erased of the cylinder gives you a very good picture of this. The circle here is embedded as a totally real submanifold of the cylinder. If you take the tangent vector to the circle and you multiply by I, you rotate it completely outside. There are no complex directions in M. And actually, the germ is unique. And in a sense, this is not a very deep result. It just sort of says that if you have a coordinate atlas, which consists of real analytic coordinates and coordinate transformations, you can holomorphically extend them and define a complex manifold. So that's really not the deep part, but it is interesting to study the geometry of complexified manifolds. So, you know, as an example, if you take the torus and you complexify, it just becomes Cn mod Zn. And you can see that this looks exactly like the cotangent bundle of Rn mod Zn, namely, it looks like Rn mod Zn cross Rn. So Bruhat and Whitney didn't make any connection to the cotangent bundle. Another example is, let's take the sphere and then let's say we take the n minus 1 sphere. It's given by this equation. When you equals 1, when you complexify it, you get this inside of Cn. You get an algebraic hypersurface in Cn. Similarly, by the way, with hyperbolic space, if you view it as being, let's say Hn, if you view it as being a hyperboloid, is it minus 1 or 1? I'll call it minus 1. Inside of Rn plus 1, this complexifies to this in Cn plus 1. So when we talk about, let's say, a Grauer tube, we're not really talking about the complexification of the manifold, which can go on for quite a while. So more on the complexification was done by Grauert. And in a way, I don't want to take the point of view that Grauert did, but a more modern point of view, but just state that Grauert constructed a certain plurisubharmonic function, rho. And it's really this object, how far you can construct it, which determines what's called the radius of the Grauer tube. Rather than go into that, I just want to mention the sort of more relevant result, which is what people are really thinking about nowadays when they think about Grauer tubes and complexifying manifolds. So this is due to Lempert and Sirka and to Gilliman, Stenzel, and actually I should be mentioning other people, Burns, Pittman, Wong. There are a lot of other people who worked on this thing. And what it says is that there exists a complex structure J associated to the metric G. So the setting is a real analytic Riemannian manifold. So here I have M and G. In the theorems of Grauert and Bruhat-Whitney, there was no metric. But now I endow the manifold with a metric, and there's a special complex structure which is actually called adapted to G on the a certain ball bundle of the cotangent bundle. So what they did was, given the Riemannian metric, I haven't defined the word adapted yet, they construct a unique complex structure on the cotangent bundle. And essentially what happens is that it's got to be biholomorphic to the complexification here. And it's the biholomorphism that does not extend beyond a grau or two. And in this picture, the metric norm function is the function of Grauert.
This, all that epsilon is measured in what metric?
G. So we start off with... Yes, we start... Yeah. What? We start off with a real analytic Riemannian metric, and we're going to adapt to it a complex structure. So in the formula, I wrote down every single side of that theorem is with reference to this adapted complex structure. So what is the adapted complex structure? Well, there are lots of ways of describing it. In fact, I would like to mention here also Gauss, Lechnam, and Stenzel. There are several descriptions of this adapted complex structure. I think they're all very stimulating for people who are interested in what we're interested in here. One characterization of what adapted means, well, it's not that hard to explain. You take the exponential map, right? And this is a map from the cotangent bundle of M into M. And we would like to analytically continue it. So, holomorphically continue it. Well, what happens? So we want to holomorphically continue in the C variable. Well, where does it go if you holomorphically continue it in the C variable? It's going to go to the complexification of M. So we end up, if we holomorphically continue it, so let me put in the square root of minus 1 so you see it very clearly. We complexify the exponential map, and then it takes a covector. I don't, by the way, distinguish covectors and vectors because we have a metric, so don't be worried about that point. So I take the exponential map, and I analytically continue it and imply it in the imaginary direction. So you can sort of imagine you're on the circle, and instead of going along the circle with the exponential map, you start going up in that direction instead. Now, that's a map from the cotangent bundle to the complexification. But this map over here doesn't extend to the whole cotangent bundle. That's the another way to put it, that that map only extends to a certain ball. So it hits well-defined germ. And the maximal ball or tube that it extends to is also called the Grauert tube. And then you can see that for epsilon less than epsilon naught, this is a biholomorphism to its image. The maximal value of epsilon for which that's true is the radius. So you can sort of see what the complexification is very directly. Another way of putting it, which is very interesting, I hope to come back to it later, is that it's also, so these are characterizations of what the complex structure is. Another characterization of the word adapted, clearly this complex structure is adapted to the metric because I'm endowing the ball bundle with the unique complex structure for which this map is a biholomorphism. So what's really true is that it's a diffeomorphism of the smooth structures, and then I pull back the complex structure here. Another way to put it is that you get these curves parts of C, I should really say, where you take T plus I tau and you send it into tau times a geodesic. So in other words, it's easier to see with the upper half plane. I'm going to embed the upper half plane into the ball bundle, which by just taking a geodesic on the manifold and looking at all the multiples of the geodesics of the tangent vectors along it, that's a two-dimensional symplectic cone, and it's The complex structure is such that these are holomorphic curves. So what I'm doing here is trying to defining the complex structure that we're putting on the cotangent bundle. Without knowing that, we can't even understand what that theorem is saying, because we wouldn't know what D-bar operator meant. We wouldn't know where we were holomorphically continuing. If you look at this formula, the length of C here is something on the cotangent bundle, right? If I wanted to restate this formula just on the complexification of M, it would be the square root of Grawert's rho. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do is, I analytically continue. So let's call this one analytic continuation of the wave kernel and eigenfunctions. I want to analytically continue the eigenfunction from M to a holomorphic function on the Bruhat-Whitney complexification, and I'm going to view this as the same thing as a Grawert tube in the cotangent bundle. So I'm going to do that. Now, I guess the first question, I think, is how are we going to use dynamical assumptions such as ergodicity to understand the holomorphically continued eigenfunction? And let me leave the statement up.
I thought we bullied you into not having to assume.
Into what?
You kind of agreed the theorem should be stated without worrying about the dynamics, rather.
Then you're going to bully me into totally rearranging how I'm going to speak. So don't do that. After we're over, we can think about modifying the discussion, okay? Because everything I'm going to say up to a point, well, let's just see what happens, okay? So the first question is, how can we get a convenient understanding of this? This does not depend on any dynamical assumptions. And the key thing is we're going to start off with the wave group. There are many different approaches to this. But we're going to start off with the wave group. And we have the following theorem. So I would say this theorem has been on my mind for over 20 years, and I keep thinking it has a nice application, so I hope this is one of them. And this is due to Boutet de Mondel in one of these 1.5-page notes without any details on any of the proofs. So it's... I'd really say that to really understand it, it's helpful to read the paper by Gulf, Leshnam, and Stenzel. And there's another paper by Gilliman and Stenzel. But nobody really gives the details on the proof. But it's not hard to do, so I probably will at some point. So here the theorem is that this analytically continues, but you got to be careful. Obviously, you can't analytically continue in the x variable, because just the simplest example of a flat torus, what happens on a flat torus? You know, you have eigenfunctions, e to the I lambda x, and you complexify them, and they become e to the I lambda x plus I c. which of course is e to the minus lambda c ei lambda x. And you can see that it's going to be exponentially decaying in certain directions, exponentially growing in other directions. The dangerous part is it's exponentially growing in a lot of directions. There's no way that this would ever be a distribution. So what it says is that if we can complexify this by rotating to imaginary time,
but in physics is called weak rotation.
Well, it's what in mathematics is simply called the Poisson kernel. So this is precisely, you know, what you learn in wherever it is that you learn it when you want to analytically continue a function with only positive frequencies on a boundary of a disk, inside of a disk. You put in r to the n, right, and up to a change, if you like, you can write e to the n log r, up to a change of variables, this is exactly that. So this is just a generalization. It is just a Poisson kernel. So the first statement is, well, obviously that decaying factor has to beat that growing factor. So the statement is that these blackboards are just a bit too small to actually state a theorem on. But the statement is that this is holomorphic. This is holomorphic in for each y, for fixed y. For zeta in the metric less than tau. So it's a holomorphic function in a Galois tube whose radius is this exponent over here. Now that's not a deep thing. It's not undeep either. Implicitly it's an estimate on the growth rate of the eigenfunction in the tube. But Boutet-de Monvel is a very insightful mathematician. His papers are very lacking in detail and hard to understand, but he puts his finger on very good ideas.
What are the variables there? So zeta, y.
So zeta, if you like, is x plus ix. I complexify.
Right inside you have an eta somewhere?
No, this is y. Okay. So in other words, I left it alone in this variable. So what is this doing? This operator here is going from, let's say, L2 of your manifold into some space of functions in the ball of radius tau. What space of functions? Well, first of all, they're holomorphic. So this is, I'm going to actually do it a better way. This is really what he proved. I'm going to look at it on the boundary. This is really important. In fact, the function rho of Grauert is what's called plurisubharmonic, which means that dd bar of rho is a positive, if you like, this matrix, d squared rho by dzj dzk bar. That's a positive Hermitian matrix. And therefore, this is a, you know, when you take rho less than tau, that is a strictly pseudo-convex domain in dimensions higher than 1. I don't expect everybody to know exactly what I mean by that, but that's the property that's actually being used in the theory. So these sphere bundles, which are boundaries of ball, the ball bundles are strictly pseudo-convex domains. These boundaries are strictly pseudo-convex CR manifolds. And this map goes into, oh, I think it is M minus 1 over 4, where M is the dimension of M. And what this means, O means holomorphic. Because we analytically continued the wave kernel, it takes its values in holomorphic functions, more precisely, the way I put it, I'm taking the boundary values. So these are really CR. If you wanted to go into the ball, the holomorphic, if you want to take the boundary values of them, which is a good thing to do, what's going to be useful for us, the CR holomorphic. And it gives you, so what this means, OM minus 1 over 4 is holomorphic intersected with the Sobolev class. That's this lambda. So you're getting this way, if you properly get to the whole boundary of the Graouet tube, you're getting actually the polynomial, you're getting a kind of estimate on the, not just the, I'll tell you what it is in a second, not just the estimate, but also on that polynomial that you've been talking about in front of the exponential term. Now this is okay, but that's still not the main point. The main point is more... What really is important is that it's a Fourier integral operator. So this is a complex... So I speak the language of PDE. To a physicist, you would say it's a quantum math. And it is associated, in other words, what map is it quantizing? It's quantizing the complexified exponential map. What is Boutet de Monvel's proof? He says, let's write out the Euclidean case. Here's the wave kernel. In the Euclidean case, let's put in minus tau for t. That's the usual Poisson kernel. Let us, maybe I'll put a different variable here. Let us complexify. Okay, I better call this this and this this. Sorry. This is over Rn. And this is the complexification at I tau x plus I c and y. And just by looking at that, you can see the integral converges nicely as long as the length of c is less than tau. And you can just look at the phase function and look at what Lagrangian manifold it generates. And you see this. That's his whole proof. Are you convinced? It is true, however, because that calculation could be done the same way in any Riemannian manifold. So he's not the usual French-style mathematician who states things in the most abstract and general way. He just does the simplest example. All right, so now why does that help us? It helps us because... It shows, let's see, what happens when you apply E of I tau to the eigenfunction? Well, by definition, because of the series formula for it, this is just E to the minus tau times the complexification of the eigenfunction. In other words, E to the I tau lambda up to this factor over here, which is going to be crucial for us, analytic continuation is a Fourier integral operator. That means that any dynamical fact that you know on the real points are going to persist when you go into the cotangent bundle, when you complexify the manifold. Okay, now, having said that, I'm going to start sketching the proof of the zeros formula. And it goes like this. So, to study the zeros, I introduce the following function. I call it U lambda. So this is going to be a complex valued function on this ball bundle. But it's not holomorphic. This is going to be phi lambda complexified at zeta divided out by the L2 norm of this the L2 norm of this on the boundary. So this is what happens when zeta lies in this particular sphere bundle. So this is, of course, the same as the sphere bundle in its sphere of radius epsilon. Okay? If you like a picture, first I have the manifold M, and then for every epsilon, I have the circle bundle of vectors of length x epsilon, which becomes this one over here. So this region over here is the is this. The boundary is this top part. And what I do is I renormalize the eigenfunction on each surface, on each sphere. So this over here is not a constant. This is a function of epsilon. Okay? Now, if you want to call this a theorem, let's call this a lemma. So if I don't, the lemma is, so this is where I assume that GT is ergodic. And it says that it's quantum ergodicity on these, on, it's the quantum ergodicity on these balls, so actually on the entire ball, that if I take this and I square it, this tends to 1 weakly in L1 of the ball. So along density 1, okay? In other words, I don't have the time to split this up at this point. In other words, if I worked on one boundary at a time, one sphere of the sphere bundle at a time, it would be quantum ergodic on that sphere. However, I've normalized it the same way for every sphere, and so if it tends to 1 weakly on each sphere, it tends to 1 weakly on the whole ball. Okay? So you could just... So let me just give a hint about that. Give a hint that this is nothing new. So you could have done the same argument without any geodesic ergodicity. And the proof is, well, just sketching the proof, that we want to understand. So the correct quantum operators, I mean, the observables to look at when you're dealing with holomorphic setting are Toeplitz operators. This is a subject that's also essentially due to Boutet de Monvel. He's the one who introduced Toeplitz operators. But we would like to understand this on each one of the spheres of the sphere bundle separately. But this is basically just taking, this is by definition just this, and then we take e to the I epsilon, apply to phi lambda on the base manifold, e I epsilon, phi lambda on the base manifold. This doesn't exactly give me my function. I have to divide by the normalization, and I have to get rid of, so when I do this, I guess I have to multiply by 2 epsilon lambda j, because these complex wave operators put in this extra factor, which involves a tube radius, so I have to get rid of that. That was not in this. And then I have to divide out by the normalization of u lambda. Okay, I'm obviously going to have to understand this expression, but my point is I can just move this over to here, and that produces the operator if I move it over I get that. Now this is where I now use the Fourier integral operator property. This goes into the ball bundle the taking its values in the symplectic cone of her of underlying holomorphic functions that preserves it, this goes right back again. This is just the identity map. I mean, in other words, it's the quantization of the identity map just by following the wavefront relations, if you like, just by following the underlying symplectic transformations. That's just a pseudo-differential operator. We knew that the original FIO had order m minus n minus 1 over 2. When we put the adjoint in, it doubles. So it's a pseudo-differential operator of some known order. Now, that's enough to be able to apply quantum ergodicity on the manifold. It doesn't matter if it's an order 0 operator or a higher order operator. So you can imagine I can completely deal with a numerator. But the denominator is exactly the same thing as a numerator, except I have the function 1. So I can exactly deal with the denominator, and all these exponential factors cancel out, all the powers of lambda cancel out. And everything becomes a pseudo-differential operator of order 0. And so this all tends to the integral of the symbol over the sphere bundle with Liouville measure. So it's simply a matter of using the Fourier integral properties of this to deduce this from the ergodicity of a sequence on the base manifold. Let me see. Now, at this point, I'm going to use an argument. So now we do some complex analysis. So the last step is complex analysis. And I should mention here that there are two prior articles which do this kind of complex analysis in a different setting with somewhat different arguments, but by Nonnenmacher and Voros, which was in 90, maybe 8 or 9 or something like that, they were looking at theta functions or your quantum maps. Quantum cat maps. How about cat maps? And by Schiffman, Bernard Schiffman and myself, on any Kalin manifold, any line bundle. So I don't have the time to even mention what's in these results, just to allude to the fact that the remaining part of the argument is going to be drawn from my paper with Schiffman. Although there are some differences caused here, but not serious differences. So, I am sort of running out of time here, but there's one very important step which I haven't exactly explained, but it sort of follows from that. So I might say as a corollary to that quantum ergodicity theorem is that the way that this behaves is asymptotic to lambda to some power like this times e to the minus epsilon lambda. That follows from this statement over here. And in fact, no matter what real analytic manifold you're talking about, you will get it asymptotic to some kind of thing like that times e to the minus epsilon lambda. So now I consider dd bar log of my function u lambda. So remember that u lambda is the complexified function divided by its moving L2 norm. So I just get something from the numerator and something from the denominator. I'm just going to put an epsilon here to mean that it's the L2 norm of it on the sphere of radius epsilon. And the first term is just our complexified zero set. And by this result over here, the second one is minus epsilon times lambda plus lower order terms. So So, 1 over lambda times this thing over here minus this epsilon. So what is epsilon over here? Epsilon is the same as the function which gives me the tube radius that I am on. So that's just the norm of C. So this minus, that's equal to this. And now we need a lemma that if this thing tends to 1 weakly, that implies that 1 over lambda z phi lambda minus c approaches 0. You can actually take the logarithm of this formula and you can differentiate it. Now why, so in my remaining 1 minute, that's the end, right? So in the remaining minute, how can you possibly do that? Well, because this is, let's see. Sorry, I needed to take dd bar here. I forgot to put the dd bar in. Well, this is where you really use the complex analysis, because we're taking the logarithm of the modulus squared of a holomorphic function. So this uses, so the passage from weak, you know, convergence of this to a sort of a strong thing to that uses plurisubharmonic functions. So, in fact, this is weak, but this is in L1. So this is a theorem due to Lelong. The theory of plurisubharmonic functions is due to Lelong, and this is kind of one of the compactness theorems. The compactness theorem says, 1 over lambda, that if, this is really a theorem about subharmonic functions, but if U lambda is subharmonic and uniformly bounded above for all j, then there's a kind of funny dichotomy. Then either uj goes to minus infinity uniformly on compact sets, or there is a subsequence which converges in L1 to some limit. So this is a kind of compactness theorem. If you rule out some really crazy behavior, convergence to minus infinity uniformly at compact sets is a usually fairly easy thing to check. You get compactness in L1 out of having these functions. And you can sort of imagine that you have an upper bound here, and using the plurisubharmonic property, you get kind of a lower bound. Okay, that obviously doesn't happen. So we find there's a subsequence of these tending to a limit in L1, and then we prove that the limit has to be 0 from the fact that this was converging weakly to 1. If this is going to converge in L1 to something, it has to be the logarithm of whatever this can converge to. And that's the end of the proof. And the end of the talk.
Any question?
This fits into a series of results of the type that if you assume, because I'm pretty sure it's about nature, the type where if you assume this, let's say, QUE for a sequence, then you get in this Hosseini thing that you guys did, the equidistribution of the zeros now for the complex zeros. Also, the Berry conjecture follows, I believe, from the Berry, what's it called?
It also follows from this.
It seems that all this points to.
I think there's no one is actually bothered to make that part rigorous.
And that follows. But it doesn't. That's probably worth working out. Maybe.
What are you talking
problem
about?
Problem session. It should be interesting to see. It all points to the fact that the weak convergence in the sense of op phi j phi j is the most basic one, because it has all these other things as a consequence, and nobody knows any of these being equivalent, backwards, as far as I know. So it's an interesting feature that the most fundamental equidistribution is what emerges. This is a remarkable result. It follows from that.
Well, you know, the way I would put it is this. Complexifying softens this problem a lot. By giving this compactness property, that weak convergence implies the strong convergence because of this compactness property of plurisubharmonic functions. You have a handle on the complexified wave functions that you never had real ones.
Your proof is nothing. I don't think there's much to add. I'm saying that it would be good to see a list.
I think there are other things you can do with this kind of complexification.
All right. Just that I'm pointing out this feature which seems to have come up in 3 or 4 problems where that implies the weaker statement, while the weak statement, like the...
That's a good question.
Zeros does not...
Does it? Does it? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, I know. So, but apparently weaker statement.
That's an interesting question, actually. Does it?
That's not... Okay.
What's that?
And it is weaker. He says it is.
Oh, yeah?
Well, you can construct the example where the zeros become flat and the resting
eigen function.
Yeah.
It has a 1/norm C singularity. So it's invariant on the geodesic flow. I should have said, by the way, that the Kähler structure, when people talk about a Kähler structure, the Kähler structure...
Just answer the question before.
Okay, that's the Kähler structure. So this thing, it's sort of a finally funny singular Kähler form. It is a strictly plurisubharmonic, it's a strictly positive 1-1 form, except where it's singular on the zero set. It has a 1/C singularity. If you take a Riemann surface, like your nodal line is one-dimensional.
Yeah.
If you look at the complex zeros, it's a Riemann surface in a two-complex dimensional manifold. So it's taking your nodal line, and as you move up, the zeros just, they actually split into two, and they kind of just go up like that. So you get a curve on every sphere bundle. And as you change your radius, you fill out a Riemann surface. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I just wanted to remark that in at least constant curvature case, your complexified functions seem to be much more ergodic than the original ones, especially when you approach the boundary.
I agree with you. There's something, when you complexify things, it's no longer this oscillating to death, which is causing the behavior. It's real exponential growth and decay. And it's strong. That's why you're getting strength when you go into the complexification. So I agree with you.
We'll follow you then.
What?
We'll all follow you then. We all want strength of the
growth. What about the integrable? Suppose you can...
Yeah, good question. So John and I are working on that. And there... looks fairly straightforward, actually, that there the zeros are not uniform, right? I mean, look on a flat torus. You can easily see that the real zeros become uniform on the manifold, but, I mean, it's easy to see this, right, that, you know, just look at the formula. It's sine of lambda x plus ixc is equal to 0, and again, it only has real zeros. So you end up with lambda this and 1/norm lambda z, and you have C lambda equal to 0. So this becomes uniform on the base, but that stays a hypersurface, a real hypersurface in the fiber, and you eventually get a real hypersurface in the cotangent bundle. And that seems to be true for any integrable system.
Another question. If you look at the points where the singularities of the real exponential map, you get conjugate points, and you get focus, and you get all kinds of nice stuff.
Yeah.
Is the radius of Grover 2 but a point or Is it sort of a local, some local geometric quantity, or what is it?
Yeah, I think what you said, it's where the complexified exponential map ceases to be biholomorphic. So some Jacobian vanishes.
Can you state what it depends on in terms of the real manifold, or...
You can write, well, like for hyperbolic space, you just write down the formula. It's the same as taking the distance between points, holomorphically continuing to R of z and w, and then making w z bar, and you get a function R of z and z bar, and as far as that function extends, that's the Grawitz tube radius. It's almost the same statement, actually, about the exponential map. I'll show you some papers with that, though.
Okay, if there are no other questions, I think.